From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, producer David Klawans has made a career digging up amazing true stories and getting them made into films like Argo and Nacho Libre. He just scored another big deal, but it took him a while to find his first success.
For several years, I didn't have a car. I would actually be on my bicycle going to studio lots, trying to, sell my merchandise. So there were a lot of struggling years.
And the creators of Wild Wild Country get Emmy acclaim for their documentary series about an Oregonian utopia gone wrong. All that coming up on The Frame. So imagine you're a studio executive and I'm pitching you an idea for a movie. An ex-cop rigs the McDonald's Monopoly game with the help of some mobsters, psychics, and even a family of Mormons. He steals almost every prize for 12 years, or about $24 million. And it all really happened. The story was uncovered by producer David Klawans. His movies include Argo, which won the Best Picture Oscar. It was based on a Joshua Bierman article in Wired. For the McDonald's story, Klawans enlisted the help of another frequent collaborator, the writer Jeff Mache. His story went online July 28th in the Daily Beast, and a few days later, it was sold to Fox and Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's production company. When I spoke with David Klawans and Jeff Mache recently, David recalled the first time that he noticed Jeff's writing.
It was this crazy story where this die-hard soccer fan for West Ham would travel around all of England to visit this team, and he would go all the games, and he would be sitting in the front. He would always be shouting at the manager of the team and the players, "You suck, you're no good." So one day, the manager, Harry Redknapp, says, "Hey, if you think you're so great, jump over the fence. I'll get you a jersey, and you play in the game." And the guy was just like, "What?" And so after halftime, he comes out on field.
That's probably how bad West Ham was at the time. They got better with this guy.
He's on the field, and he actually scores a goal.
No way. In a Premier League match?
This was a preseason friendly, but it was professional. And it was the first time in history that a fan had played in a professional English soccer game. So it was a bit of an urban myth. I'd been following this story for over 10 years. I'd always wanted to interview the guy, but no one could ever find him. And it was like folklore in England. And eventually I did find the guy, or rather he found me. He emailed me and said, I understand you're looking for me. And I flew back to England to interview him. And it was my first long form story. It was nearly 8,000 words.
And was there film or video of this?
It was just before
camera
phones.
Well, there's actually pictures of it.
But no.
We dug up some pictures to prove it. And I told his story. And it was the first story that I told in like a three-act structure. It was the hero's journey in soccer cleats. And it was the first story that I wrote that went viral, as they say. And one of the first emails that I got was from David Klawans, who announced himself as the producer of the movie Argo.
So where is the soccer movie? This sounds like a great...
Well, it's actually in development at British Independent Company. And...
see what happens.
Yeah.
So at what point do you guys start talking about a story? Is it, David, you have your notes, you have your ideas, and I know it probably varies from story to story, but is there a typical starting point where you start having a conversation about a potential collaboration?
Well, basically, I spend hours and hours in archives trying to find these obscure stories, and there's certain elements in a story that I think would work as a long-form piece and then perhaps become a movie. And so I've spoken to Jeff about some of these stories I find, and then we talk about which ones would work the best.
And why does it need to be a story? Let's just say you have a great idea. You can't just pitch that. Are producers and executives and studios more responsive to the story laid out in print? What changes?
Well, it basically becomes a piece of intellectual property.
I see.
It's almost impossible these days to sell a pitch or a spec. You could back in the day, not today. Most movies that the studios want are either comic books or horror movies or animation. And so able to create my own IP in a sense.
And if you were to think back over the things you've done with Jeff and some things you've also done with Joshua Bierman, who did Argo, Coronado High, and Jailhouse Rock, would you say there are identifiable elements that these stories have, even though they're often radically different tales?
Yeah, I think they all are sort of truth is stranger than fiction tales. They deal with very rich, juicy characters. They all have stories that are deep in conflict, and they all sort of have a bit of a comical angle to them that I think makes for a successful piece.
So, Jeff, let me ask you a little bit about the McDonald's story. What was the initial conversation? How much was known about this? And how did you decide that you wanted to pursue this as a journalist?
Well, David came to me with some initial research about the case. And this story was largely unknown because the trial started the day before 9/11.
Right. So the media, after that, we all kind of forgot about everything else. Yeah.
So most of America didn't know about the case. And when I read about it, I was just blown away. And when you have multiple characters with unbelievable arcs and that comical element that David mentioned, that's what makes a good read. That is what is irresistible to my editors. And in the McDonald's story, it's that, you know, truth is stranger than fiction X factor that I love.
And this was an epic scam. I mean, $24 million in stolen prizes by the head of security for the company that produced the winning tickets, involving some kind of third-tier mobsters, strip clubs. I mean, he associated with some very strange people. And yet, because of 9/11, very few people knew this story.
What we saw in the trial, and I went to great lengths to get the trial transcripts and depositions and stuff like that, you have this, it's the pinnacle of American greed. And that is really powerful for me. As a journalist that investigates crimes, to find these untold stories that chronicle American greed, particularly in a time right now where people are very focused on corrupt officials and FBI investigations into corruption and collusion. The overlying theme of the McDonald's story is that truth prevails, that justice prevails. And in the end, the FBI did get their man.
Coming up, more with Jeff Mache and David Klawans, who uncovered the amazing story of Jerome Jacobson and his massive McDonald's monopoly scam. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll return now to my conversation with producer David Klawans and journalist Jeff Mache. Klawans has built a career on uncovering some amazing true stories that translate nicely into feature films like Argo and Nacho Libre. His latest sale was for the rights to the story of Jerome Jacobson. For years, Jacobson, who ran security for the company that made the game pieces, fixed the McDonald's Monopoly game by siphoning off the winning tickets. He then had friends and strangers cash them for a cut of the prizes, totaling millions of dollars in kickbacks and winnings to Jacobson and his many co-conspirators. Jeff Mache wrote the article about the scam for the Daily Beast after Klawans shared with him some early research. Here's David Klawans.
You would see in these articles, like, I won $1 million. I couldn't believe it. In the back of my seat of my car, I found a hash brown box, and there was this winning $1 million ticket. I can't believe. And then there were other articles of this one guy jumping up and down with his son, and it was completely all fake. And actually, deep in the archives, I had discovered that there was a lot more going on with Jerome Jacobson, the ringleader of this whole thing, and that there were actually other people that had not been reported that he had given tickets to. And so that was also interesting.
Basically, the scam was bigger than the FBI knew. Right. And we were finding out on top.
Yeah, like, so I found a winner that lived 40 miles away from him that won $250,000.
That the FBI had not tracked.
That the FBI had not. But I saw it in an article. And so then we were like, this is a bigger deal than we think here.
David, the story was published on July 28th and sold to Fox for Ben Affleck to direct and Matt Damon to star in on August 2nd. So very quickly. In all the reports, there was this words of an auction. So first of all, do people stumble upon the article? Do you actually send the article to producers, executives? studio people you know? And then what happens afterward, and how quickly do you get a sense that things are starting to go fast?
Well, for this particular one, I did sneak it out to a few studio executives before it came out. But this is something I'd never seen before. I mean, it came out on a Saturday evening, and by Sunday morning, it had gone massively viral. It was all over the place. It was the number one story on Twitter, Facebook. Other publications were picking it up. By Monday, it was just all over the place. And so I knew come Monday morning that a tsunami was coming of various offers on this particular one. I could just feel it. And sure enough, it was as if it was a movie fantasy league list. I mean, you would get these calls, you know, saying this actor wants to do it, this filmmaker, this screenwriter, and it was just nonstop.
So what are your other collaborations right now of articles that you've written that are in various stages of development?
Well, we have a project at Fox Searchlight, a spy movie. We have at Netflix this romantic comedy based on a true story catfishing story, internet catfishing. We have a project we are working with Will Smith that's based on this crazy Aretha Franklin story.
And then what's the high school cheerleader story?
That's actually the only one that we've done that we haven't been able to set up, and it's a crazy story about this.
What's your pitch? Let's hear it. Maybe somebody will be listening. Go ahead.
This story I love because it got me in the best American sports writing for the first time, and I'd just become an American as well when it came out. It's the story of a 33-year-old woman who stole her daughter's identity to re-enroll in high school and make the cheerleading squad, something she never did herself because of her teenage pregnancy.
And she could pass for a teen.
She got into the squad.
Yeah.
Paging Sandra Bullock. And what's the Aretha Franklin story?
The Aretha Franklin story is about this 26-year-old woman in 1969, up-and-coming gospel singer, who was actually forcibly kidnapped and had to perform as Aretha Franklin to a bunch of sold-out audiences in the South. And
because Aretha didn't want to go on?
This was back before satellite television, so no one really knew what they looked like. This is true. I wrote this for the Smithsonian magazine earlier this year. She played three or four sold-out concerts across the South in 1969.
And she was good.
Everyone thought they were seeing Aretha Franklin.
That's unbelievable. Probably the most important question surrounding this McDonald's movie, $24 million scam, a lot of people went to jail. What is the Happy Meal promotion tie-in going to be when the film comes out? What are you looking for? Have any ideas that we should share with McDonald's right now?
Maybe there's a Jerome Jacobson character.
Like a bobblehead?
Like a bobblehead?
Yeah.
I'm nodding yes, but I'm really saying no. David Klawans is a producer. Jeff Maish is a journalist. Maish is the author of the Daily Beast article, How an Ex-Cop Rigged McDonald's Monopoly Game and Stole Millions. We pick up now with a documentary series that attempts to retell another complicated true story that, outside of Oregon, might not be well known to many people.
We basically got introduced to this story through an archivist who said that he had over 300 hours of never-before-seen footage on the story and told us that it involved a cult and mass poisonings and assassination attempts of state officials. And we went, surely he doesn't have that right. And we began reading and researching, and surely enough, everything he had kind of said was true.
Chapman Way co-directed the Netflix documentary series Wild Wild Country with his brother McLean. The series about an Oregon-based religious group led by the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh earned 5 Emmy nominations. I spoke with the Way brothers when the series premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year.
Basically, the movement had started in the 70s, and he had an ashram in Pune, India. And Bhagwan was an Indian guru, and he was really well-liked by Westerners because he was probably one of the first gurus to say, you can have wealth, you can be rich, you can have sex, and you can still be enlightened. He wasn't a guru that said you need to dispose of all that to become enlightenment. His message was really one of Western capitalism and wealth and making money.
They ate vegetarian food and they wanted to farm their own land and have a self-sustaining community and a lot of sex and don't be ashamed of your wealth. He was known as the Rolls-Royce guru because he owned 93 Rolls-Royces. And so I think he was a provocateur. He was very much known for inventing dynamic meditation, which is a very physical form of meditation, jumping up and down, breathing loudly.
Dynamic meditation is a combination of Hinduism and psychotherapies.
He was the first one to say meditation can be in work, it can be in dance, it can be in singing. And so it really attracted a lot of creative types, a lot of intellectuals at the time, and a lot of really like successful professionals who had kind of reached the pinnacle of their career, found that they weren't fulfilled, and kind of went on this journey for fulfillment.
Bhagwan was very modern, very hip, a fashion. He appealed to the intellectuals.
Like Manan Sheela was the guru's secretary. Sheela is really pretty much our main character of the entire series. A lot of it is through her lens.
Intellectuals who were tired of the tradition and mundane lifestyle. The time that I came to know Bhagwan, he was on a full power. It was unstoppable power.
The guru took a 4-year vow of silence, which basically put Sheela in charge of the entire operation for when they were in America. And she was kind of in charge of a lot of the decision making. So essentially, she was running the entire $100 million business and operation in the press face of the movement.
As secretary to the Bhagwan, Ma Anand Sheela oversees both the church and the commune. And until recently, Sheila's husband ran the investment corporation.
They come to Eastern Oregon, they buy a 64,000-acre ranch, and they spend about $125 million turning it into just an incredible utopia.
We wondered, you know, who these people are, why are they here, how long are they going to be here, you know, what's this about?
Right away, they tried to have all the roads around them closed so people couldn't come in, and you started wondering, well, what is it that we're worshiping here, and it wasn't long before the Bhagwan came, and we got to see what it was.
This group, there wasn't some promise of an afterlife, or it was basically a meditation community, which we think, okay, that doesn't sound that crazy, but in the 80s, it really was viewed as what's going on here. But there's an interesting section where we really dissect the word cult. What does that mean? And we find that really it can be weaponized. It can be used as a way to delegitimize other groups that think differently than us, that we don't agree with. And so they felt Jonestown, Jim Jones was a Christian. It has nothing to do with Indian mysticism. From their point of view, you can't get farther away than from what we're doing here. But I think cult hysteria was kind of at a peak after Jonestown. And Americans, and especially Oregonians, saw this group in all red with a mala and just assigned them these labels that maybe they didn't feel were appropriate.
But essentially what they do is they buy this ranch, they incorporate legally as a city government, and they start building.
I'm here in one of the largest ranches in the Northwest, 100 square miles of Oregon. Used to be known as the Big Muddy Ranch. Today, it's Rajneesh Puram, because a prominent Indian guru and his followers bought it, hoping to turn it into an oasis for their guru, the Bhagwan.
Very beautiful city, a city, one which has never existed on the universe, where people live in harmony, people live in love.
And that violates state land use law. So the first battle is these state land use laws. Essentially, that pushes them into Antelope, Oregon, a separate town but very close by that's already incorporated. They literally take over Antelope. They buy houses. They move people in. They put their own Rajneeshis on the city council. And that's where you come in and get the perspective of the Antelopians, which is this cult. That's what they think it is. They think these people are brainwashed cult members. And they come in and start taking over their town and completely eradicating their way of life.
Coming up on The Frame, more with filmmakers Chapman and McLean Way on their Emmy-nominated Netflix series, Wild Wild Country. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The filmmaking brothers McLean and Chapman Way co-directed an engrossing six-part documentary series on Netflix called Wild, Wild Country. It tells the story of how the followers of the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh built a compound in Oregon in the early 1980s. The show has earned 5 Emmy nominations, including Outstanding Documentary or Nonfiction Series. The Way brothers interviewed members of the Rajneesh community, including the guru's spokesperson slash enforcer, Ma Anand Sheela. Sheela was a key figure in the group's effort to gain political control over its corner of Oregon, which involved taking advantage of liberal voting registration rules in the state.
Slowly but surely, the ranch just starts to increase their political power as they start to try and take over Wasco County. The 1984 Wasco County elections are coming up. The Rajneeshis figure, if we control Wasco County, a lot of our problems are going to get solved. So they institute a plan to bus in 5,000 homeless people from across America. And they do. They bus in 5,000 homeless people, try to register them to vote. That doesn't go as planned because basically Wasco County officials suspend registration of voters.
Just real quickly, a lot of these homeless people were Vietnam War veterans, and so it created an incredible situation where people had fought for our country were being told that they wouldn't be allowed to vote, which I don't know if we tried to do a lot of research. We couldn't really find any other instances in like the history of America where voter registration was just completely shut down and no new people were allowed to vote. And so that's also just a side thing, but it is really interesting the pressure that this group put on our American institutions that we value so much, and to see how we as Americans responded to the situation. Yeah.
The Rajneesh's idea was to legally pad the voter rolls with these homeless people that they'd bust in from other states, which soon led to more trouble in the community.
Yeah, there was this inciting incident where Sheela thought that she could calm down this homeless man who was kind of, from all accounts, bordering on the edge of psychosis, is what we were told. And this homeless man grabs Sheela by the neck, and Sheela has a line in the documentary where she says, "I thought I was going to die." And she says it pretty seriously, and I think sincerely she felt she was going to die. So she overreacts in a way that is almost like unimaginable, which is they have Haldol, which is a tranquilizer for schizophrenia, and they spike it in the beer that they give the homeless people. And then that's just the beginning of a long list of criminal activity. In the series, we wanted to give the viewers an idea of what the intention was of this community, but as you work your way through the series, I think you start seeing missteps after missteps after missteps that lead them towards a path that you know this isn't going to work out.
I was charged of heinous crimes and locked up in a prison for 4.5 years.
Federal prosecutors in this country have asked the West German government to extradite Ma Anand Sheela to the United States. Sheela, a former secretary of the Bhagwan Rajneesh, faces charges of fraud and attempted murder in Oregon.
A lot of the bigger crimes, there was an attempted murder on the ranch of Bhagwan's doctor. That they served time for that. There was a big immigration charge violation where they were arranging sham marriages.
It was illegal wiretapping. Basically, Sheila had wiretapped every single room.
Oregonian received information today that the police investigators who've been working here at the ranch also have been victims of bugging and wiretapping. That since they came here, the wiretapping and the bugging has been continuing.
Here's where it gets complicated, is those were all clarified as state crimes. There was one federal crime, which was a conspiracy to assassinate the U.S. attorney for the District of Oregon, a man named Charles Turner. Although there wasn't an attempt made on his life, it still met the legal standard for what a conspiracy was, because people got together, they discussed where they would kill him, and they bought guns to actually commit those crimes. There wasn't enough evidence to prosecute then, so what a lot of these Rajneeshis did is they served time for their state crimes, but there was this weird federal conspiracy hanging over their head the whole time, that the statute of limitations was 5 years. And so basically about a week before, in like 1990, about 5 years later, the federal government brought charges against this conspiracy to assassinate the U.S. attorney. And that's what created a whole like legal just conundrum for these people, because they were overseas. They thought they had served time. Re-extradition requests went out. It was a whole kind of like part two of the legal battle.
So Ma Anand Sheela ended up serving time for her state crimes, and she never served for her federal crimes. She was released out of prison a week early, got on a plane, went to Switzerland.
Now, I request all of you good people, and you too, leave me alone.
She's now currently on Interpol. She's not allowed to leave Switzerland. If she does, she will be charged for the federal crimes. So that was part of the reason why we had to go to Switzerland to interview her and meet her there.
If you have doubts,
Live with your own doubts. Don't dump it on me.
One of our goals, which is a little hard to articulate, was since we were doing this in a long form way and we were really excited about that, we wanted to show two vastly different perceptions of the same event that happened. And I think you'll feel that as you watch the documentary. If you're listening from a Roshnishi, we have edited and scored that piece through their lens, their perspective. If you're hearing through an Antelopian, we have edited and scored that piece through their perspective. And so I don't know if we ever felt that comfortable really deciding at the end who was right and who was wrong. I think that hopefully this documentary generates a big conversation that you will have with the people that you watch it on how you feel about it. I mean, I've screened this for close friends, and some of my close friends can't stand the Roshnishis. They think they're spiritually arrogant. They think that they totally identify with the Antelopians. They make points that are like, dude, if people came in wearing head to toe and red with a maul around their neck with AK-47s, I would want them out of my town too. I can't stand these people. And then I've screened it for close friends of mine that think that these Antelopians are backward conservative bigots, and they think that the Roshnishis were on a total awesome path towards ambitious city building.
Showing the two sides wasn't, I don't know if this sounds good, but it wasn't done in like a morally righteous way on our side. I know a lot of documentary filmmakers take a lot of pride in showing both sides. It truly was, I think, the most entertaining way to build up both of their arguments, and the audience can decide, how do I feel about this? How do I feel about gun rights? How do I feel about separation of church and state? All these kinds of really complex issues, and hopefully it's done in an exciting way that makes you want to watch it.
McLean and Chapman Way are the directors of Wild Wild Country. It's on Netflix now. And that will do it for today. Remember to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.